On this episode of Padres Corner, do you know what it takes to keep you in the lifestyle that you want? Is solar cooking birds over the Nevada desert? And we've got Brian Chee talking about his years of government service. Let's get geeky.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Padres Corner is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Padres Corner, Episode 2, recorded August 19th, 2014. Brian Chee and the Government Service. Welcome to Padres Corner. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit. This is the show on the Twit TV network where basically I put you into the mind of a priest and see if you come out sane on the other side. No, but seriously, Leo and Lisa got together and they said that we needed something for our chat room. We love our chat room. It's the interactive part of Twit, the grand experiment of the Twit TV network. So they decided to give me an hour a week here on Tuesdays at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time to talk about the stories that I find interesting. They don't necessarily have to be tech. They don't necessarily have to be recent. They just have to be interesting to geeks like you and me. And let's get right to it. The first story we have here is all about NASA. I'm hoping that you like NASA. I love NASA, but they need your help. That's right. The folks over at NASA are reaching out to the public in hopes that you'll give them the same energy that you give to scanning cat videos on YouTube. They want you to help them categorize the pictures in their data backlog. The problem that they're having is that they have more than 1.8 million photos in their back catalog. 1.3 million of those are from the ISS, and 30% of those were taken at night. And some of the photos date back to the Mercury missions. However, those photos were never properly categorized. They weren't given any metadata. We don't really know where they're from or who took them or where they're pointed. And they want to fix that. Now, they could write an algorithm, but the folks over at NASA have realized that algorithms aren't really good at noticing the fine details that would tell a human brain where that picture is, like noticing the curves of a highway or noticing that there's more lights in one area than another, which would denote a city. The human brain is the greatest supercomputer possible to do that task. And so what they've done is they've introduced us to a new project. The new project will divide the pictures into three levels of participation. It's called the Gateway to Astronaut Photography of Earth. Now, what they want you to do is they want you to pick a level of participation. The first level is called Dark Skies. Now, this is the organization of photos into cities, stars, or miscellaneous objects. Then there's Night Skies, Night Cities, that looks at those 30% of the images that were taken at night. Now, people are asked to use their knowledge of local geography to match the photos with positions on maps. Now, these photos will also be used to generate light maps of cities at night, which, if you've ever seen them, those are absolutely beautiful. And NASA is saying, we've got the photos, we just need your help to map them out. The third category is lost. Now, these are the photos that are the toughest to identify because there is no indication of where the astronaut was pointing the camera. And again, it's one of those things that the human brain can do almost instantly, but the smartest supercomputer can't do at all. Now, if you want to check them out, drop by our show notes and find out where you can find this Gateway to Astronaut Photography of Earth, and maybe you could loan a few of your brain cycles to creating a masterwork of NASA's art. Let's move on to the next story. This is almost NSFW, so I want to give everyone a fair warning, but I think it's something that's important to talk about. When we think about living in cities, when we think about living in society, when we think about the things that have to happen in order for us to live our comfortable lives, most of us put it out of our mind because we don't want to see those dirty jobs. We don't want to see what needs to take place in order for us to have our apartment or our house or our running water or our sewage systems. But that doesn't mean that they don't exist. Well, Vice had an interview with a man who works at a sewage treatment plant, and the interview that they did was interesting. They interviewed a man by the name of Brendan Walsh. Now, every morning, Brendan Walsh wakes up. He has his morning coffee. He reads the paper. He drives to work. He suits up. Then he jumps into a vat of human waste. That's right. Brendan Walsh is a poo diver. Brendan is a systems engineer and a certified diver who just happens to be responsible for the machinery at East West Dive and Salvage in Australia. It's responsible for, among other things, the aeration of human waste in order to get bacteria to eat the waste and therefore break it down. Now, these systems keep the cities alive. These systems keep the cities from filling up with sewage, but every once in a while they break. And when they break, they have to send someone down there to fix it. That's Brendan's job. Now, imagine the job. You're in an airtight suit, but you're only a pinprick away from having the most incredible infection ever. It's pitch black, you work by feel, and the crew above you gives you directions in real time. Go left, go right. Now, when you find the problem, you have to repair the machinery by memory without seeing it. You're completely blind. There's no way to see past the muck that's crowding your glasses, your goggles, and you don't even want to think about what that muck might be. Oh, you might be feeling squeamish, and I wouldn't blame you at all, because it is hard to see the muck and the nastiness that our society lives on, but there's a deeper point to be made here. Brendan does this job because it pays well. Brendan does that job, and others do that job like him, because we're willing to pay a premium to keep the dirty business of our lives away from what we have to do on a daily basis. But Brendan works for an industrialized nation. Imagine this. Imagine doing the same job, doing the same tasks, having to crawl through sewage, but you don't have a suit, and you don't have a team, and you don't have tools. In fact, the only thing you have are your bare hands and feet. Folks, this is what happens around the world. Just go to Google right now and type Indian sewage workers, and you will find legions of pictures that show you what people have to do to keep cities in India working. Whenever the sewer system clogs up, someone has to crawl down there and unclog it. Well, a human being is cheaper than a robot. And again, it's one of these tasks that's thankless, but absolutely necessary for society to exist. I'm not saying that everyone here should go and clean out some sewage pipes to get the life experience, but I think real geeks, true geeks, always want to know the systems on which their life exists. And once you start taking a look at the systems that allow you to live the way you live, maybe you look a little bit different at those people who do the jobs that none of us want to do. Maybe you'll think about thanking the garbage collector or thanking that man who cleans the side of the freeway. Maybe you'll take a woman out for a beer when you realize that she does the dirty jobs that you don't want to do. And I'll go one step further. If you have a nasty but necessary job, if you have to do something that's kind of squeamish for the rest of the population, why not film it and send it to me? I'll put you on Padres Corner because we want to thank you for making our lives possible. Let's move on to the next story. And, if you're a bird, you may want to stay away from Nevada. Now, if you've seen the reason for this, if you've ever driven to Vegas from Los Angeles or San Francisco, there are huge state-of-the-art solar thermal plants in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Now, the Bright Source Energy plant, which is the one that made a lot of waves because they're sponsored by Google, cost about $2.2 billion and is the world's biggest power tower solar thermal generation plant. The way it works is that they have 300,000 garage door-sized mirrors mounted on these sun-tracking posts that reflect the sunlight into one of three power towers. Now, they say that this plant is the biggest of its configuration in the world, and it allows them to generate, along with its sister plants, 13,000 megawatts. Yeah, 13,000 megawatts. That's a whole lot of power, enough to generate enough power for a city like Los Angeles to run on. Now, for birds, this is a problem. You see, because all of those mirrors reflecting that sunlight are focused on one point, it means that it's going to attract insects, because insects will be drawn to light. Well, when the insects are drawn to the light, the birds are drawn to the insects. And that's what's been happening at this solar plant. They've been finding what they call streamers, birds that fly into the quote-unquote death zone and immediately burst into flames. Now, how bad is it? Well, they had an investigator from the Center for Biological Diversity wander over to the plant, and he described at least one streamer every 2 minutes, which means there are thousands of birds being killed across all these plants each and every single year. They're calling it an ecological disaster, and they're calling for the plant to be shut down until they figure out a way to keep the birds from being hurt. But here's the problem. There really is no way to keep birds from doing what they're going to do. They're going to go after insects. There's really no way to keep the insects from doing what they're going to do. They're going to go after the light. And to shut down the plant means that we're going to have to get the energy from someplace else. Now, there are people who are saying that this is going to be a tragedy. There's going to be a lot of birds that are getting killed. I don't debate that. However, I always try to look in the long run. And in the long run, I'm thinking, how many birds would be killed by the same amount of energy being generated by a coal-fired plant? What kind of ecological disaster would be created if we use a gas-fired plant? What sort of consequences do we avoid by using the sun's power on a bunch of power towers to create steam in the middle of the Mojave Desert? Ultimately, folks, it's always about comparative risk. What are we willing to risk? What are we willing to pay? And what are we willing to bear in order to get the benefits of green power? That's what the Mojave plant is all about. Now, all of this talk about green power has me thinking that a rant is coming on. I do want to talk a little bit about green power, but before that, I've been always a Doge guy, but wow, zero-G is a dick to cats.
You can see the disorientation resulting when an animal is suddenly placed in a weightless state. Cats, when dropped under normal conditions, will invariably rotate their bodies longitudinally in midair and land on their feet. This automatic reflex action is almost completely lost under weightlessness.
By the way, if you didn't get that reference, that's filmed inside the Vomit Comet. It's a specially modified jumbo jet that flies parabolic arcs so that it can simulate zero-G for a length of time. I've always wanted to know what happens to cats when they didn't have a sense of up or down. Now I know. Now let's get on to Padres rant for the week. I want to talk a little bit about green power. Now, there are people who watch the beta episodes of Padres Corner, and they figured that I was a pro-nuclear nut, that I wanted nuclear power at all costs. And that's not really the case. If you've read my writings on the matter, if you've actually seen my postings, and if you've listened to me talk throughout the episodes, you'll know that I like any sort of alternative energy. I understand that there's going to be a deep growth of the requirement for power over the entire world, that as more countries come online, as more countries become industrialized, we're going to need to find new sources of power. And I believe that renewable energy sources are a big part of that. I just don't believe that they're all that there is. But I want to talk right now about a triumph for the energy industry, for green power, and that's Germany. This last May, 2.5 months ago, Germany hit a historic landmark with their green energy efforts. Through the midday of a Friday and Saturday, their solar plants produced a whopping 22 gigawatts of electricity per hour. That's the equivalent of 20 medium-sized nuclear power stations operating at full capacity. Now, for the first time in history, a large industrialized nation produced 30% of its weekday power needs through solar, which was a momentous occasion. Now, this path to the momentous occasion started with the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Right after the earthquake / tsunami / nuclear disaster in Japan, Germany set off to abandon nuclear power. They shut down 8 of their nuclear plants, and they've got plans to shut down the remaining 9 by 2022. They invested billions of dollars in renewable energy sources, including wind, solar, and biomass. And it's paid off in spades. Germany now has more solar power generation installed within the boundaries of its country, within its borders, than the rest of the world combined. That's right. They've even got more than China, who until last year was the absolute world leader, the world dominator in the amount of megawatt hours installed for renewable energy sources. So Germany obviously did it right. Now, many have pointed to this historic power generation as the reason why we no longer need oil, and we definitely don't need nuclear. After all, those power sources are dirty. Those power sources are dangerous. Those power sources lead to horrible, horrible things like the Fukushima disaster. But, well, the problem is, that's not all there is to it. We need to look at this event, at this historic, momentous occasion, and look beyond. On those days that Germany generated all that power, they, well, they were on an off day. The 50% figure came from a Saturday, and the 30% of their needs came from a Friday. Even with all of the renewable energy sources that Germany has, solar still only accounts for 4% of its total energy consumption. And remember, they are the most installed base of renewable energy in the world. Renewable energy in Germany accounts for only about 20% of their actual power needs. And critics have pointed out that the push for renewables have added 2 cents per kilowatt hour on top of the already higher than the rest of the industrialized world cost of 23 cents per kilowatt hour. They also point to the fact that the influx of renewables have made the grid less stable as renewable sources come on and drop off throughout the day. Specifically, that in order for it to be a useful, clean energy source, consistent energy needs to be added along with the renewables. This is something that many energy pundits have been trying to explain over the years, which is it's good to want solar, it's good to want renewables, it's good to want energy sources that are carbon neutral, but we also have to consider what happens when those energy sources are not generating. Personally, I'm a big fan of the next generation nuclear reactors. Anyone who's watched Padres Corner before knows that. And the reason why I'm a big fan of the next generation of nuclear power reactors is because they're not like the previous generation. Remember that the nuclear power plants you see every day, that you hear about, that make the headlines because there are accidents, were designed before and during the Cold War. The reason why they were designed the way they were designed is because we wanted nuclear plants that could generate the fissile material that we needed to make nuclear weapons. Well, if you do away with that requirement, if you no longer require your nuclear plant to make the fuel that's going to power a nuclear bomb, then you actually have a really, really safe process. There's one right now, the light wave reactor and the sodium reactor that actually soaks the nuclear fuel within salt. Now, here's the cool part. As it gets hotter and hotter, the salt molecules actually expand and it pushes the fissile material further and further apart, which will reduce the rate of reaction. As it reduces the rate of reaction, the reaction starts to die. In other words, we have reactors now that are impossible to melt down. Now, here's a bigger part. There's a huge amount of fertile material in the United States that we could be using in these next-generation reactors. About 700,000 metric tons of depleted uranium-238, which can no longer be used inside of a standard light water reactor, but would work fine in a traveling wave reactor. If you were to stack all of that fuel into a solid block, it would fill a football field to about 30 meters. Now, even taking conservative estimates of how much power that stockpile could generate, it would sustain just what we've got, 80% of the world's energy consumption, even assuming if the rest of the world consumed energy at the same rate that we do. Comparatively, nuclear waste is a tiny amount compared to the waste of other energy-producing methods, including, and I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for this, solar. Now, before we get all crazy and you start to believe that I'm telling you that nuclear is the answer, because that's not what I'm saying, what I really want you to think about is, in the end, anyone who tells you that they have the solution for our future energy needs is either lying or deluded. There is no magic bullet. There is no one solution that's going to fit all. There is no one energy source that's going to fit the needs of every single country. There will be some sort of combination of renewables and nuclear energy and probably even petroleum. And until we see that, and until we're willing to work within that framework and realize what we want is we want something that is more carbon neutral, we want something that is more friendly to the environment, we want something that is more friendly to economic development, then we're always going to be having this fight between people who actually want the same thing. That's the end of my rant, and I think I need a cleansing breath. So how about this? Over this past week, we've seen a lot of these ALS challenges. You know, when people dump buckets of ice over their head? Well, that's fine and all, but there are really some people who shouldn't try it at home.
To an ALS foundation.
Three!
Oh!
You're up.
I think he left her.
Oh,
I'm so sorry, Pod. Slippery.
Justin Moniz.
I have to go potty.
God, man.
Yeah, here we go.
Don't worry, folks. No ice buckets were harmed in the making of that video. It seems that some people have not yet grasped the fact that water is actually pretty heavy. So if you're going to do an ice bucket challenge, make sure you do it right. Now, we welcome to the show a good friend of mine, my co-host for This Week in Enterprise Tech. He's a man, he's a mensch, he's a guy who geeks out quite a bit, Mr. Brian Chee. Brian, thank you for coming on to Padre's Corner.
Hi, Padre.
It's good to see you, my friend. How have you been?
Oh, not too bad. Trying to eat the learning curve on some new gear from Extron.
Oh, wait, what are you playing with?
It's a digital signal processor. It allows me to... basically eliminate a mixer being run by human hands. It'll actually go and auto mix for me. And it's going to go into the new video wall for the Department of Emergency Management.
Fantastic. Now, Cheever, we've brought you onto the show because you are a true geek. I mean, of all the people that I've met, you really kind of fit the definition of what a geek, of what a nerd really means. You're passionate about what you do. You strive for understanding. You want to learn everything about everything that you use. And I find that very admirable. But there was a question that we had last time you were on the Twit TV network that kept popping up in the chat room. And I want to ask it of you right now. And that question is, Brian Chee, can you confirm or deny that you were... are now or ever were a spy for the federal government?
I was never a spy. I was spy support.
Don't go any further. I know that's going to get you into trouble. Okay, so that's what you did with the GSA. I think we can put to rest. People are always going to say, well, was Cheever a spy? You weren't a spy. You did spy support. But that's just part of the fascination I have with your life. Because after the GSA, when you decided to become a private citizen, when you decided to start getting back into academia, you went to the University of Hawaii and said, look, here's what I can offer you. And you created the world's largest independent testing lab. Tell me what that's all about. Why do you need a testing lab?
Okay, first and foremost, I think the official is we were the largest independent testing lab associated with a publication. In this case, it started off as Communications Week, which changed its name to Internet Week. And when Internet Week died, in fact, Kurt Franklin, your other co-host, he and I got pink slipped a day apart. And I was on hiatus for about a year, and then InfoWorld picked me up. Now, the whole deal with testing, which personally, I think there's an awful lot of people that should be testing, you know, just ask the Internal Revenue Service or Obamacare. Too many people don't try and test their systems, be it hardware or software, and find out where it breaks. Under what conditions will it break? So what I tend to do is I create very large simulations using synthetic traffic with people like Ixia, Mu Dynamics, Spirent, HP, and a bunch of others. And what I do is I'll go and get statistics from friends at various large and small and medium-sized corporations. And I will create those simulations based on those statistics. And then I'll go and run it in the lab. At one time, I had enough equipment in my lab that I could simulate the traffic that you'd typically find on the entire North American continent. And we've done some big, big, big tests. I think it was 1996, we did the first large-scale ATM test, and we rolled in the door with about $12 million worth of ATM gear. We did some of the first gig tests. We certainly did some of the first 10-gig tests. We've done some of the largest, one of the largest server tests on Earth. And we kept getting bigger and bigger. In fact, one test when we did identity management, we actually had a mainframe as part of the test, which is kind of cool. But the whole idea is we'll go and test it to, well, first we'll confirm whether or not their brochures are accurate. You know, if they're going to publish it, we're going to test it. Then we're going to do the what if. What if we really crank it up? You know, kind of like what Mythbusters does when, you know, the Bic lighters didn't blow up the car. Of course, you know what they had to do? They had to go and put some C4 in there. You know, we do kind of the same thing. And we've actually set a few products on fire. We actually had one product that they had never tested it to its capacity. And when we ramped it all the way up, we heard something like popcorn going. And when we pulled the boards out, which were smoking and letting out the magic blue smoke, there were craters in the tops of all the transceiver chips. They had literally blown craters in the chips, and that's what the popcorn sound was. We've also done bypass wireless, where we've actually shot lasers and microwaves between my building and a small mountain next to me, and use GPS synchronized test equipment to go and measure the true latency. You know, was it really the speed of light, or did this equipment introduce a lot of latency? Because the scenario we were testing was, can you use this to run a VoIP installation at your main office and then shoot down the block to another branch office and not have to put an entire PBX there? We've also done another big test where we coined the name Fergenschmeyer.com, and it was Oliver Riss, another co-host, that came up with Fergenschmeyer. And the whole deal was when Harry met Sally. So Harry met Sally when Fergenschmeyer and TCPIP.com merged. So you had to show the directories being merged. Then Harry married Sally, so you had to go and show how Sally's personnel records would change. Then you had to go and catch Harry falsifying some credentials and trying to change his records on the Active Directory. And you had to catch him and lock him out. And then you had to show in the ERP system, because it was all scripting based, that when IT removed his credentials, it also kicked off changing Harry's records in the ERP system. And then Sally divorced Harry, and you had to show that change.
Cheever,
I
want to ask something here. And again, if I go too far, just tell me and we'll move on. But one of the things that I've heard from our This Week in Enterprise Tech audience is they don't understand why an independent lab might be necessary. They go to the same conferences that we go to, and they say, wait a minute, we get all the specs that we need from the vendors. They've tested everything, and they there are other labs that get paid to test. Why would I go to an independent? Because an independent lab is costly.
Yeah, well, it actually comes down to this. The reviews that you're reading in a lot of magazines were contributed by the vendor themselves. Do you believe them? I'm not sure. I'd like to have some independent verification of those statistics, if you please. The other thing is, we go and try and create scenarios that mimic what a corporation might actually be using it for. Sometimes those statistics that the vendors put out are ideal conditions, and we're going to go and test it under non-ideal conditions. In fact, we're going to try and mimic the real world as much as possible. And this is something that's really, really missing from the market today.
Yeah, I don't want to mention any names because I don't want to get in trouble. But I remember when I first started listening to you and I first started reading some of the material that you forwarded me to, I read about some of these labs that I trusted a lot when I was doing consulting work. Now, they were supposed to be the blue ribbon, the gold standard for testing. They were the ones who, if they said this piece of equipment could do this, then I could trust that it could do it. And I was shocked to find out how much corporate sponsorship there went on of those particular testing agencies.
Oh, you bet. Well, Keith, let's really put it in perspective. A 1 week test that involves usually a PhD and a whole bunch of minions to help them. If you wanted to go and get, say, IEEE 1588 verification of precision time, if you get, say, a commercial entity to do this, that's $50,000. with that kind of money on the line, you want to be able to pump out a lot of tests as fast as you can. And keep in mind, this test equipment is really freaking expensive. You know, at one time when I did a 10 gig test, we had over $2 million worth of Spirent gear in the lab. So unfortunately, there is a great temptation to just, you know, rock and roll and get as many of these things done as possible because you're paying mortgages on these very, very expensive pieces of equipment. Yeah. And unfortunately, a few of these labs have been busted doing a pay-to-play type of thing where the results were paid for at the beginning.
And actually, I can speak from personal experience here. Some of the conferences that we went to after TWiET became popular, you know, so we had a little bit of a name. I was approached by representatives of companies who they wanted a spot on TWiET. And I'm like, okay, well, we'll look at the calendar and we'll try to set something up. And we need to get your topic and we'll prep you to make sure that you understand who our audience is. And a question that I get more times than I don't is, well, what's the cost? So how much do we have to pay you to do this? And I'm thinking, for the first couple of times, I was like, oh, you don't have to pay us. Are you kidding? It'll be fun to have you on. But then I realized there's a whole segment of the industry that's used to that. They believe they need to pay for any good press. And the flip side of that is they believe that if they pay you, then you have to give them good press. And that's just, I mean, I didn't know what to do. I still kind of look at that and go, is this the industry that we work in now?
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is, yeah, I've actually had some testing labs take the scripts and the methodologies that I created, which, oh, by the way, I make them open source once the test is published. They've taken my work, put their name on it, and charged megabucks for them, and then didn't run the test right so that they could go and get the outcome that was paid for by a corporation. It's way, way too common.
All right. Now, Cheebert, we know that you're a fascinating person. How about this? You want to go over a few stories with me?
Oh, of course.
Okay. This first one is about a little conference that we just went to last week, right? Or maybe the week before. I can't even remember. It's all a blur. DEFCON. DEFCON 22 in Las Vegas just happened. And one of the interesting things from DEFCON was the leader of the show, a man by the name of Dark Tangent, that's what we call him, saying, we need to get back to a radical simplicity. Now, what does radical simplicity mean for a geek and for a nerd? What Dark Tangent was talking about was to start looking at what we could do without, how we could reduce our electronic footprint. In other words, if we want to be secure, if we want to be safe from people prying into our business, what are the things that we could change about the way we communicate, about the way we compute, about the way that we network that would reduce our exposure? For example, he said, you need to have data access between two computers. Why use a switch? Why use a whole network if you can get away with a crossover cable? You need to access a repository of data. Well, do you have to do it over the internet, or could it be something that's stored in-house? Do you need to give data to the person next to you? Well, why would you use Dropbox? Why would you use wireless if you could literally hand media to the person next to you? Oh, Cheebert, what I want to bring up is this is almost anathema to geeks like us. I mean, we're built on the idea that you want to connect everything. You want to have access to everything, anytime, anywhere, on any device. And for someone who the geek and the security community respect to say, maybe we don't need all these connections, I think it sent a lot of ripples. What are your thoughts on this idea of radical simplicity?
Well, I answer this with a question. Gee, a horse and buggy is sustainable, and it's economical, and it gets you from point A to point B. Yeah, but I like driving a car. Having infrastructure means that you can, if you have reliable infrastructure that you know is there and you have, say, excess capability, it means you can start thinking about what other things can you do with it. You know, that is what happened over at CERN. They needed a way to exchange information. They knew that, well, maybe this was a little convoluted, but this thing that they developed called a web browser sure has changed the face of the earth. So I tell anyone that says maybe we should simplify things, yeah, there's no reason why you have to create a Rube Goldberg contraption just to share files at home. But maybe if you had a NAS and a switch and a network infrastructure within the home, maybe, just maybe, your smart appliances can now have a web server so you can display things, or maybe Drupal or Joomla, so that your kids can have a schedule and you can keep your family a little more synchronized. Because in this hectic day of moving around and people having different schedules, having a way to asynchronously share information together is a pretty good thing. So yeah, simple is nice, but sometimes having the capabilities makes life even more interesting in ways that you can never imagine when you first started.
I want to go a slightly different way, maybe even play devil's advocate a little bit here. I understand what you're saying. It's like, yeah, of course. I mean, if you want to get real secure, well, why not go back to paper and pen? You know, why have anything stored electronically at all where it's very easy to make a copy? In fact, isn't that what we've been saying about security in the modern day and age? That, of course, spy agencies like the NSA and our allies overseas, of course they're spying on electronic communications because it's so easy. You and I both work at Interop. You and I both have experience with the kind of monitoring that takes place when you've got really good equipment. So we know exactly how deep our inspection can go. We know how futile it is to try to hide something from a system administrator. But Cheever, I would throw back at you and say, just because it's more convenient to have these tools, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to use the tools that are going to make it incredibly easy for someone to spy on us, right? I mean, let's go back to your analogy of the horse and buggy. Yeah, of course, I don't want to drive a horse and buggy. I want to drive my car. But that doesn't mean I have to drive my car with a Wi-Fi access point blaring off the top. It doesn't mean that I have to drive my car with absolutely no security checks, with no credentials needed to get into the vehicle. I think that's part of that radical simplicity, right? I mean, the radical simplicity is the idea that open is not always better. You know, always connected is not always the ideal.
Well, the analogy I used to use is, gee, you know you've gone too far when you have a computer flushing the toilet for you. But lo and behold, there's now a computerized toilet from Toto that does exactly that. Sometimes I think we may have gone just a bit too far. I think we need to apply technology in a responsible manner. You know, the fact that you can plug a device and hack a car way too easily because there's no security involved, in my mind, that's a little irresponsible. And, you know, I'm going to actually get up a little bit on my soapbox here. I have been ranting at the academic community saying, hey, computer science students need to learn how to talk to the real world. Just because they can make pretty web pages that, you know, have dynamic capability behind them doesn't mean they're really talking to the real world. How about being able to go and get the temperature of your home so you can maybe change the air conditioner setting so you can save energy when you're gone, and then before you head home, change it back so it'd be nice and cool when you get home? Computer science students typically aren't taught this type of thing. Electrical engineering students design great hardware, but these are the people responsible for SCADA. You know, they've designed great control widgets, but there's no security involved. I've actually been involved with helping to redesign some of the SCADA networks on some of our ships that go to sea, and it absolutely freaked me out when I asked what the password and username was and said, there is none. And I just go, you've got to be kidding me. And literally, anyone that could get a connection into the control network on most modern ships could actually take over bridge functions without too much trouble. That is scary, and I consider that pretty irresponsible. So the bottom line on the soapbox is electrical engineering and computer science can't be separate silos anymore. They have to have cross-listed classes. They need to be able to share information together and cross-pollinate the two coursewares. And we need to do better. And I think that's what the bottom line is. We can do better. we don't necessarily have to go crazy with technology, but we need to be more responsible in the application of the technology.
That makes sense. I think Dudes Fried in the chat room has the quote of the night for me, and it's, well, I'd hate for my commode to get hacked. By the way, my parents' Toto toilet, it does not flush the toilet, but it does wipe my bum. Let's go on really quickly to another topic that's actually from the same weekend. We were at Black Hat, and at Black Hat, both of us were a little bit blown away by the keynote speech of Mr. Dan Gier. Now, Dan is a cybersecurity professional, but what he brought to the conference was a wonderful philosophy that I think people weren't ready for. I mean, when we think of keynote addresses at Black Hat or any security conference, we normally think of these people who kind of pontificate and they talk about how this technology is going to save the world or that technology is going to save the world. Dan went in a different direction, and we got a chance to speak with him. We're actually going to have his interview on This Week in Enterprise Tech in, I believe, next week. But he listed 10 things, and among those 10 things that stuck with me, he wanted the U.S. to purchase zero-day exploits and share them with security professionals. He advocated people going offline at times whenever they actually needed privacy. He also advocated for holding companies responsible for data breaches and incentivizing them to be as transparent as possible about breaches to the public. But the one I want to talk about is he spoke about the right to be forgotten. Now, Chibert, we've talked about the right to be forgotten on the TWiT TV network, and most of the time we ridicule it. We talk about how, well, it's stupid to think about removing something from the internet. Well, of course you can't remove something from the internet. Nothing can ever be removed from the internet. But he brought up a very interesting point. He said the right, the ability to start over, to recreate yourself, is such a fundamental part of what it means to live in a society that we need to be very careful about when we give it up and be very cautious about using systems that would make that impossible. I want to throw this over to you because he actually did make me think about this. When I sat down with him at the Q&A and I talked to him about the right to be forgotten, he kind of made a lot of sense. This whole idea of, yeah, of course, there are going to be those jerks who abuse the system, who use it to scam people over and over again. But there is something so fundamentally human about the desire when we really screw up to step away and reinvent ourselves and to become someone else. Does that make sense? I mean, do you think that's something that we should protect?
Yeah, maybe that little interview with this Jesuit priest about things I did for the government. Erase, please.
Yeah. Nope, that's on the internet forever.
Nah, it's a nice thought. I don't think it's terribly practical anymore. A lot of things require an identity, and they need to have some trust in that identity. Things like banking, things like, your human resource records and things like that, your employment history. Dan basically kind of said, I'd like to be able to just start over as if I was just born again, I think is the words he said. And in this day and age, I'm not sure that's terribly practical, especially because his career and my career is based upon what I have done. Now, should we be able to really and truly erase your history, or at very least abandon your history and start again for things like, witness protection comes to mind, or battered spouses? Sometimes starting over should be available, but I think it needs to be used very carefully, because when you can erase yourself or make yourself disappear off the electronic footprint, that also means the abusers can skip out on loans. We're seeing that lots and lots of times now with student loans. These people have started off with massive, massive indebtedness when they graduate from college, and they just can't seem to get ahead, especially when the economy tanks. Do we want our financial institutions to not be able to find them anymore? That's one thing that I have to throw out there. Dan, I like the concept. I like the wishful thinking, but I don't think it's terribly practical, not when the world is so interconnected as it is now.
I like what Untoward in the chat room is saying. You know, after a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, people used to just move to Australia. He's making a joke, but it is that spirit of, if you're willing to give it all up and if you're willing to admit that you screwed up and you did a horrible, horrible thing and I want to start fresh, that doesn't seem to be available to us anymore. I mean, your electronic footprint follows you forever. I'm just thinking of how much fun we used to have when Facebook first came out, when MySpace first came out, and these young professionals or students would put these pictures that were of them in a compromising position. And we would call them stupid. We'd say, oh, that's, why would you do that? That data is still around, and that data still haunts them. And that data still sticks with them every time someone tries to apply for employment. So I don't know. I was firmly against the whole idea of the right to be forgotten, because I thought it would break the internet. You know, that's not what the internet is. The internet doesn't want to be controlled. The internet can be controlled. But maybe I'm just getting kind of old and fogety, but maybe there is something that should be done to guarantee that people who want to make an honest effort to reinvent themselves and who want to leave their past in the past have that ability to do so. I don't know. Maybe again, that's just me.
It's a nice thought. But I say a little bit of counter on this, that the human resource people, when you're doing the hiring, for God's sakes, put it in perspective. If he or she was in high school and their hormones are blasting and they did all kinds of stupid things to impress a girl or a guy, for God's sakes, don't hold it against them. You know, this is... Maybe what we need to do is say, if once you hit the age of 18, human resource people can no longer touch anything beyond that. You know, be realistic. This is, again, you know, being stupid or being silly about how you're applying technology. People have a past. People do make mistakes. We're all human. So I say to the human resource people, come on. Be reasonable. You know, don't hold it against them, you know, unless, of course, they're bragging about being an axe killer, you know. But even still, we have sealed criminal records for kids under 18. Let's see if maybe we might want to do that for things like Facebook and MySpace and things like that, especially when it comes to trying to make a career for yourself.
I don't know. Ethereal communication sounds good in practice. But I have not yet seen a really bulletproof implementation. Now, Chima, let's step away from this, because we've been serious the whole episode, aside from the fact that we talked a little bit about your GSA work. There is one story that I do want to get your input on, because I think you might have a nice slant on it. And that's about, those kids who make really bad decisions and then end up moving back in with their parents. This is a story about some Chinese parents who are suing their son to make him get a job. Su Qing is a 29-year-old man who has not had a stable job since leaving university. His reason? Work is too boring. After finishing his university work, he moved back in with his parents in Beijing. His father got him a job at a friend's company, but Qing quit after 3 months, saying it was too dull. He now spends his day sleeping and surfing the internet, pretty much like me. But he did manage to find a girlfriend who was also jobless and bored with her work, and now both of them live in his parents' house. So his parents have gone to court, and they have sued him, and they won. The court has ordered him to get a job or move out. He has refused to get a job, and now the parents have to go to the police to see if they could start eviction proceedings. Let me bring this to you, because it sounds really funny. It sounds really strange, but this is actually not all that unique. I've heard these stories over and over again. And not even with family, but with squatters. It's so hard to get rid of somebody who just doesn't want to work anymore.
Yeah, I'm related to a few. You know, it's so sad. You know, you go to university, you spend all the time, in theory, to prepare yourself to be a contributing member of society, and then you drop out. I've worked very, very hard on my education. I've worked very, very hard on my chosen profession. It's literally a full-time job just to stay caught up. But for those people that decide that it's just too hard, too boring, you know, too dull. My opinion is, suck it up. Come on.
I can't say that, but I would take the same approach. Oh, one of the interesting aspects of this story is that there is there's a strong community that's pointing to this as a result of the one child policy in China, that because there's only one child per family, which I'm not going to judge because, again, it's done a really good job of population control. But it's made parents want to baby their children and treat them as if they could do no wrong. So if that's how you treat your child when they grow up and they think they can do no wrong, what happens if suddenly they decide, I don't want what you want from me? I'm just going to sit here and relax and play games and watch TV.
It actually goes beyond just the one child per family. I'm seeing it time and time again, especially in immigrant families. Here in Hawaii, I see lots and lots of kids where the parents or grandparents really had to struggle. They sacrificed everything to make sure the kids could get a good education and so forth and have a better life than they had. But now these kids don't know how to work for it. They don't know how to earn their way in the world. They don't know how to make a place for themselves. I see it time and time again, especially in these high school kids that feel entitled to have everything handed to them. And then all of a sudden they get dropped into the real world. And now all of a sudden they have to go and work for a living. Oh, gee, I can't go surfing all day. It's a tough call. And, you know, I like what my uncle did. He literally told his son, oh, you want a car? Fine. Go to the junkyard and build a car. Then I'll help you.
I like that. At least make them work. Get them out of the house.
Yeah.
Chibert, I want to thank you for being with me. This was a lot of fun. You know, and again, this is what I want Padres Corner to be. We don't have an agenda. We're not bound by our title. We don't have to talk about a single topic. It's just a couple of geeks who want to talk about some stuff that they hold dear. Again, could you please tell the audience of the Twit TV network, the people who are watching Padres Corner right now, where they can find you, both on the Twit TV network and off?
Well, I'm on Twitter. My handle is at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. What I'd like you to do is right next to my name under our guest in the doc, I have a URL. I'd like to do a shout out to the McMoon gang. They literally have taken over right next to a NASA facility, an abandoned McDonald's, and they've taken over a abandoned NASA satellite, and I think they're going to try and use it. They've increased the orbit so it can circle the sun and bring science to the public. Let's see, where is it?
Wait, why did we not talk about this? They took over an old NASA satellite?
Yeah, dude, bring up the URL. It's right next to my name in the doc.
What? Are you kidding me?
Oh, no, dude, it's awesome. They actually did a Kickstarter and raised enough money so they could actually get equipment installed at Arecibo. And now they're controlling it. They actually have a whole bunch of retired NASA engineers that refurbished a whole bunch of gear in order to talk to this really, really old satellite. And now they're driving it. And while NASA hasn't officially blessed it, they're kind of saying it's a silent blessing. So there's the gang in front of the abandoned McDonald's. This is actually just outside of... Oh, geez. What's that NASA base? Ames Research.
Oh, my God. So this is right down the peninsula.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I got to go visit
that. Just find the abandoned McDonald's just outside of Ames. They are going to be doing a Google Hangout as they start driving the satellite around, and they're making the data coming off that satellite, the raw data feeds, available to anyone that wants it.
How did they get a satellite that still had fuel in it?
Actually, I think it's out of fuel. I think they used the last little bit of fuel to get it into a big orbit around the sun.
That's incredible. Okay, I will admit, that's a story we should have talked about. We should have thrown that in the dock, because anytime amateurs get to take over an orbiting satellite, I think that's amazing. That's very, very cool.
Go McMoon.
McMoon, indeed. Chibert, thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you for being part of Padres Corner again. We'll have you back when we need to talk about more spy stuff. But until then, sir, I salute you.
Take care, everybody.
Now, I want to thank you. That's right, the person who came by to watch Padres Corner. We want to spread the word about this show. It's going to be a lot of fun. Next week, we've got David Hewitt, the actor who plays Rodney McKay on the Stargate in the Stargate universe. He's going to be coming back and geeking out with us over God knows what. It's just this informal time for us to talk about the stuff that's important to geeks. And please stop on by. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/Padre, you're going to find all of our increasing episodes, and we're going to make sure that our show notes end up going in there. And you'll also find this. It's a way for you to get the show automatically into your device of choice. If you want the audio version, the video version, the high-definition version, whatever you want on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your laptop, your desktop, we're going to make it easy for you to get Padres Corner because, well, we love you. Also, you can find me throughout the week on the Twit TV network. On Mondays, you'll find me for This Week in Enterprise Tech, 2:30 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, you'll find me right here, 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time for Padres Corner. On Thursdays, you're going to find me at 11 o'clock for Know How with Cranky Hippo. We're going to be doing some maker and DIY projects. And at 1:30 with Snubs to talk all about programming. Until then, I'm going to be hanging around here in the Brick House, hoping that you'll join me next week for Padres Corner.